I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program provides food vouchers to 47 million Americans. That's 14% of the population. The program has grown dramatically since 2008, the start of the recession, from $38 billion a year to $82 billion today. The SNAP program is set to be cut by $5 billion tomorrow, November 1st, when the stimulus bill, passed back in 2009, expires. While supporters say food stamps provide essential support to low-income families hit hard by the recession and a tough economy, critics argue that the program is unsustainable and breeds dependency and abuse. Well, today in Radio Times, what will the cuts mean for recipients? What is SNAP's track record? And how have beliefs about poor people influenced the debate about this and other safety net programs? Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Michael Katz. He's the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History and a research associate in the Population Studies Center at the University of Pennsylvania. His book, first written back in 1989, The Undeserving Poor, has been updated and revised. And Michael Katz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us and joining us by telephone is Diane Schanzenbach, and she's Associate Professor of Human Development and Social Policy, also Chair of the Institute for Policy Research's Program on Child, Adolescent, and Family Studies at Northwestern University. And Diane Schanzenbach, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Let me begin with you, Diane, if I could, and help us understand for those families who are on food stamps, as we call it, or as are part of the SNAP program, what does this mean to these families?
Well, the food stamp program is designed to help prop up families' ability to purchase groceries. So these are relatively modest benefits. You know, I think average benefits are about $4.50 per day. And so it's designed to be used in conjunction with families' other resources that they have from work or other sources to make sure that they can provide a healthy and balanced meals on their tables.
And supplemental is a key word there, right?
That's exactly right. Most families use this in combination with other resources that they get primarily from work, especially primarily from work when the economy is going well. We've, of course, seen this large expansion in the food stamp program over the last several years, and we think most of that is just driven by the fact that the economy has been so bad.
And in terms of the voucher, or I think sometimes it's a debit card, what can and can't a food stamp recipient buy with their SNAP voucher?
So recipients can use these in the grocery stores to purchase almost any sort of normal grocery store product. So, fruits and vegetables and cereal and things like that. There are a few restrictions, such as, of course, no alcohol, no cigarettes, no paper products, and also no hot food intended for immediate consumption, so no rotisserie chickens, things like that. But in general, you should sort of think of it as normal foods that you would buy at the grocery store to bring home and prepare.
Michael Katz, let me get you in on the conversation. I want to read something from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities about food stamps or the SNAP program. 87% of SNAP recipients live in households with children, seniors, or people with disabilities. One in four U.S. children live in a household that receives food stamps. Roughly half of adults will go on food stamps sometime between the ages of 18 and 65. And between 2008 and 2012, one in five households with children sometimes did not have enough money to buy food. We're talking about a country with a lot of poor people or low-income people, yes?
Yes, we are. We're talking about a country in which poverty is a serious and enduring issue, and where it has become more serious in the last several years. Food stamps has become just an essential part of the social safety net. It provides the only income for a shockingly large number of families who live in deep poverty.
And when we see that the food stamp program has doubled in size in the last, 5 years since the recession, do you see that as largely driven by the recession, that it has put so many people at risk or so many people into poverty?
I think it's a combination. I think it's a combination of this Great Recession, which has increased the number of people in poverty, and also by cutbacks in the social safety net. which has had a terrible impact.
When we talk about, your title is the undeserving poor, are you saying that Americans, we tend to put the undeserving poor in one category and the deserving poor in another category?
That's right. You know, this is the oldest, most enduring way of thinking about poverty. It's a distinction that is at least a couple of centuries old. You know, ways of thinking about some people as worthy of help, other people as unworthy, as undeserving. And this, you know, the identity of the people in these different categories has varied over time with historical circumstances, but the moral distinction itself, this tendency to see poverty as a problem of persons, inhering in their own behavior, in their own inadequacies, in their own pathologies, this is just a long-standing a facet of the way in which poverty has been discussed.
And Diane, I want to get back to you, but one more question to you, Michael Katz, which is, so if we're talking about 87% of SNAP recipients living in households with children, seniors, or people with disabilities, which category are they in? Are these the deserving or the undeserving poor, using your designation?
Yeah. Well, children usually have been the deserving poor because they're too young to have brought their brought their poverty among themselves, and people who are hungry are generally seen, you know, in a more favorable light, and people with disabilities. So I would think that by and large, this 87% of children would be among the deserving poor.
Let me turn to you, Diane, because you did a long-term study looking at something like 12,000 children in Tennessee. This goes back to the 1980s. First of all, what were you looking for and what did you find?
So we have a series of papers looking at the introduction of the food stamp program, actually as it rolled out nationwide during the War on Poverty. So it started in 1961 and it sort of slowly gained momentum up until 1975. And so this is a really great laboratory for trying to compare what happens to children who were born in this county versus another county and so on. And so what we found was that children who were in utero, who their mothers were pregnant when the food stamp program came on, were born at healthier birth weights. They were less likely to be low birth weight, and they were healthier. Of course, this program was introduced before the WIC program was introduced subsequently in, I think, 1976. And the food stamp program is about 10 times the size as the WIC program. So it's, of course, probably not that surprising that, you know, when low-income families are given access to more resources, that children are healthier. But what I think is most surprising and that we found most recently was we were able to follow up these children who were exposed to the safety net in their early life through their adulthood. And what we find there is not only were they healthier as children, but now those are continuing to pay dividends in adulthood. They're healthier. They're less likely to suffer from metabolic syndrome, which is obesity and diabetes, things like that. But then most interesting was as adults, the women who were children exposed to the food stamp program are more economically self-sufficient. They were more likely to graduate from high school, more likely to be currently employed, and in fact themselves less likely to be reliant on the safety net as an adult. And of course what we think happens there is, you know, when children are given adequate nutrition and adequate resources, they're better able to do things like pay attention in school, you know, and benefit from the investments that society makes in them in other areas, and then those have these long-term payoffs.
Why don't we know that? And the reason I ask that, I mean, this sounds like it's longitudinal study, it's comparing and contrasting, it's looking at a program over decades and finding some positive results.
Right. I think it's very important news, that there's positive long-term impacts of public policy. And, of course, that's what we're trying to do. And it's pretty exciting that we're finally able to sort of crack the nut and figure out how to measure that in a credible way.
But the idea is that these early-on investments, even in utero, have some payoff or some benefit even into adulthood.
That's right. There's more and more scientific evidence coming from all sorts of fields, like neurobiology and economics and all over the place, coming together to really see that early life events are very deterministic for later outcomes. That's not to say that we shouldn't intervene, you know, sort of at later ages, but if we can target investments in early life, they might just be more effective, more efficient spending.
What do you think?
Than targeting later.
Michael Katz, what's your takeaway from this research?
Well, I think it's research that is of extraordinary importance, and I'm just fascinated by it. For one thing, it is powerful evidence that, you know, government programs can work. That in fact public programs can produce positive results, and we really, really need that story to be told, to be emphasized in this era when we're living in such anti-government times.
Well, one of the reasons we're doing this show today is that scheduled tomorrow, $5 billion in cuts from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, or food stamps, and there is this kind of disconnect. So here's some research showing some positive results, and yet it looks like money's going to be cut from this program, Michael Katz.
Yes. Well, one of the discouraging things about being a researcher in the poverty and social welfare field is how hard it is to take research and have it make a dent on people's people's
perceptions
and assumptions and prejudices.
Do you see it that way, Diane?
Yeah, yes, I agree. And I think that there's a lot of misinformation out there about what this program does. So among families with able-bodied adults who have children, the majority are combining food stamp benefits with work. I mean, these aren't sort of handouts to, you know, what might be considered the undeserving poor. This is a supplement, and I think there's broad agreement in America today that we do want to make sure that that children and workers are able to have a living wage and have enough to consume. So I think that there's a lot of debate right now about sort of very small subsections of the food stamp program, mm-hmm. or sort of there's a concern that the roles have increased so much, and I think we've sort of forgotten that, well, the way that this program is designed, it's supposed to expand when the economic times are bad. It's supposed to help ensure people's consumptions in bad economic times. And the best way to reduce the size of this program is not to cut it, but to grow the economy and make sure there are plenty of jobs.
Well, let me pick up on that after this very short break. And that's Diane Schanzenbach, Associate Professor of Human Development and Social Policy, Chair of the Institute for Policy Research's Program on Child, Adolescent, and Family Studies at Northwestern University. Joining us by telephone, obviously, and here with us in our Philly studios, Michael Katz, the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History, Research Associate in Population Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And his 1989 book has been updated, Revised: The Undeserving Poor. We're talking about food stamps, the food stamp program, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at wistar.org.
At a time when trusted news and analysis is critical to understanding our complex world, your donations to WHYY during our membership campaign is the best reason why we're bullish about the future of public media. This is Bill Morazzo, President. Having a growing number of WHYY members makes it possible to have the financial strength to give you the news you expect from us every day and to grow those services to meet your needs for tomorrow. Thank you.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University, featuring An Evening with Bob Woodward, Friday, November 1st at 8 p.m. on the Westchester University campus. Part of the President's Speaker Series, Woodward will be presenting a talk on presidential leadership and the price of politics. Since 1971, Woodward has worked on the Washington Post, where he is currently an associate editor. He and Carl Bernstein were the main reporters on the Watergate scandal, for which the Post won the Pulitzer Prize in 1973. WCUPA.edu/WCU Live.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The food stamp program is scheduled to be cut by $5 billion tomorrow. That's when the temporary funding from the 2009 stimulus bill will expire. That means something like $29 less per month for a family of three. Talking with Michael Katz and Diane Schanzenberg, and we are taking calls, Schanzenbach, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I wonder too, and I'll put this to you, Michael Katz, and I guess going back to the sort of deserving and undeserving, as Diane was telling us, something like 80% of families who are working receive food stamps, which tells us that, and I always cringe when I say the working poor, but we also know even from this economic recovery that, yes, we are adding jobs, but many of them are low-wage jobs. It seems like it's harder and harder these days to get out of poverty. Is that true?
I think that is true, because real wages for ordinary working people have actually been going down for a long period of time, really since the mid-1970s. So a huge number of people, a very large proportion of workers, do not make enough to get by just on their wages alone.
And Diane, going back to you, and you talk about some of the misbeliefs about the food stamp program, and I know that there was this surfer, he played in a rock band, and he was trotted around as an example of the abuse of the food stamp program, apparently buying lobster and sushi with the food stamps that he got from the government. I mean, this happens, but and it seems to, for whatever reason, seems to resonate with at least some people. What do you make of that?
You know, his experience is so far out of the norm here. And so I think, you know, what that shows is there are some holes through which people, you know, who don't really need the program, who, you know, want to abuse the program, can get in. I think the evidence, for example, from the Congressional Budget Office is that those holes are pretty small. And furthermore, if we really want to tighten those holes and make sure no surfer dudes in rock bands can get on this program, what we'll have to do is spend a lot more on administrative costs. And I think that, you know, in general, we don't think it's a great idea to maximize the amount of red tape and money that we're spending on administering a program, you know, just to make sure that a couple of people, you know, who, you know, are trying to game the system are forced, are, you know, are allowed through.
I mean, Michael, reminds me of the welfare queens of yore.
Yeah, I mean, it's the oldest trope in criticisms of social welfare type programs is to single out an individual who abuses the program and generalize from there incorrectly to the entire population.
But for some reason, it resonates. Whether it's the press, you know, hypes up these stories, or for whatever reason, it resonates with.
Sure,
with
I mean,
the
they're great stories. They feed people's instinctive prejudices about the programs.
Diane, going back to you, if a family of three is going to lose $29 out of their allotment from the SNAP program, what do you think that means?
Well, we do know that this was supposed to be a temporary increase, and you know this was part of the stimulus package, and so you know this is basically just going back to the historic levels of food stamp payments. So there's no question that families are going to feel the pinch of this, especially because you know the recovery hasn't really taken hold all that well for especially low-income families. So that, you know, they're still suffering from high unemployment and so on. So there's no question that will hurt low-income families.
But what I heard you say earlier is that in order to get people out of this program, we have to grow the economy. We have to create jobs that pay a good wage.
That's right. That's right. You know, if we want to take the long view of this, we need to do that. We also need to make sure that, you know, kids are growing up and getting enough skills that they're able to obtain high wage jobs in the future. And so, you know, really, you know, this, we should think about the food stamp program as a Band-Aid, as, you know, sort of a temporary prop up. But while we, you know, that it sort of responds when other bad things happen, like a recession.
Going to you, Michael Katz, and you've been studying poverty for decades now. And there have been some programs, I guess, that have helped, or certain times in this country's history when we've been able to get people out of poverty. I'm thinking of the Social Security Medicare program, got a lot of poor elderly people out of poverty. Have we sort of run out of tools these days?
That's a great question. Let me just back up for one second. I mean, I think it's important to remember that in Pennsylvania in 1912, the average food stamp benefit for a family of three was about $526 a month. So we are not talking about, you know, feeding people in any kind of luxurious way, even in an adequate way. I think it's really important to remember. The most successful anti-poverty program in this country was Social Security. As late as the early 1960s, the elderly were three times as likely to be poor as any other age group in the population. Now they are less likely to be poor. It's a huge, it's a huge success. We have, you know, raised incomes of people who are not too far below the poverty line, particularly the working poor. Mm-hmm. Really, since the 1990s, with the expansion of the earned income tax credit and other kinds of family and child credits, the income, public programs, federal programs, by and large, have raised the incomes of single working mothers significantly. So, in fact, we do have an array of tools that we could use. There are also other tools that we really haven't begun to touch that would be even more effective. But we could certainly, with tools that we know about, do a great deal better.
And Donna, I know you have to leave us. Anything you want to say before we say goodbye?
I think just adding to that point, the Earned Income Tax Credit has been a great safety net innovation over the last 20 or so years, but it only works when there are jobs to be had. And so what we need is, especially in times of recession, is for that to be coupled with something like a universal safety net like the SNAP program is. And so it's very important that this program be retained and be able to expand in bad economic times when the Earned Income Tax Credit is not effective, because it only works when there are earnings and when there are jobs.
When people are working.
That's right.
Well, Diane, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's Diane Schanzenbach, and she's Associate Professor of Human Development and Social Policy, Chair of the Institute for Policy Research's Program on Child, Adolescent, and Family Studies, and that's at Northwestern University. Michael Katz staying with us. He's the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, and his book, The Undeserving Poor, written back in 1989, has been updated and revised. Joining us now is Julie Zapes, and she's Policy Manager of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger. And Julie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. We've been talking about the $5 billion that's going to be, unless someone comes in the next 24 hours, it's going to be removed from the food stamp program. What's the impact going to be on Pennsylvanians?
So the impact in Pennsylvania is huge. Every single recipient of SNAP in Pennsylvania will see their benefits drop overnight. So that's 1.8 million people in Pennsylvania who will be losing benefits this November. For a family of four, the decrease is going to be $36 a month, which may not sound like a lot to some of us, but for families who are really counting every penny when they go to the grocery store, that's a big impact on their food budget, particularly as they get close to the end of the month.
And if we're talking about 1.8 million Americans in the Pennsylvanians in the American in the SNAP program, are we talking, Julie, rural, suburban, urban, sort of across the state?
It's absolutely across the state. Here in Philadelphia, there are about 475,000 folks who receive SNAP. But where we've actually seen the biggest growth in the program over the last 5 years is in the suburban counties in this region. So in Montgomery, Westchester and Bucks counties, we've seen participation in SNAP more than double since the start of the recession. So there were certainly folks in every county in the state who are going to be impacted by this cut.
And Michael Katz, does that surprise you that we're seeing the growth of poverty in the suburbs?
No. I mean, there's really a lot of research, notably a recent publication from the Brookings Institution, which tracks the growth of suburban poverty, which has been the fastest growing element in poverty growth in the last several years.
I mean, Julie, what are these families going to do? I assume they'll go to food pantries, other ways of getting food for themselves.
Yeah, so we're actually concerned about what the impact is going to be. We operate a food resource hotline, and we are expecting our phones to be ringing off the hook as soon as benefits hit for the month of November. In talking with our partners who operate food pantries and soup kitchens, they are really strapped already. They are stretched to capacity with the current need. And so we're really concerned that they are going to see many more families and seniors showing up at their doors that they may or may not have the capacity to serve. Our partner Feeding Pennsylvania estimates that with the cut in SNAP benefits, that's the equivalent to 69 million meals lost in Pennsylvania. And that's more than half of the total meals distributed by Feeding America food banks in Pennsylvania right now. So they would have to increase their capacity by 50% just to make up for the loss of these SNAP benefits. And there's no possible way for them to do that. So we're definitely concerned about what the ripple effect of the cut is going to be in our communities.
Let me ask you, this is a more economic question, Michael, which is that if someone gets food stamps, they're spending those food stamps in a grocery store or a supermarket. I mean, that money gets invested gets spent in the economy.
Sure. And that's one reason why farmers and the food industry like food stamps.
But because of the economic benefit.
Sure, sure.
And if I can jump in and let you know about the economic impact of these cuts in particular, Pennsylvania stands to lose $183 million in SNAP benefits because of these cuts just in the next 11 months. And in New Jersey, the loss will be about $90 million in SNAP benefits. So that's a huge economic impact for Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of the retailers are then forced to cut back hours for their cashiers and their baggers because they are seeing less business with these cuts.
And Michael, there used to be bipartisan support for food stamps. I mean, you know, looking at the history, you can see that it seems that until recently that there was sort of unanimous support for helping people who are poor make sure they get food.
Yeah, there was. But we've, of course, moved into an era of intense partisanship with a social politics that has moved farther to the right than any within living memory. So much of this consensus has broken down, and any government program has come under deep suspicion, and there is, you know, perhaps less sympathy for assisting poor people than at any point that I can remember.
I do want to get to our callers, Julie, but I know one of the things that happened this summer was really to decouple this food stamp program or the SNAP program from the agriculture bill, where in the past they used to be together.
Yeah, and that was really unprecedented to see the reauthorization of SNAP separated from the reauthorization of the other programs that are part of the Farm Bill. And I think that part of the history of bipartisan support for SNAP has been that rural and urban legislators have really come together to pass this bill every 5 years to keep both these farm programs up and running, and then also the nutritional supports that are so crucial in all of our communities. And it was a disappointing move to see the House of Representatives specifically divide those two programs in the legislation. And I'm concerned about what that means for SNAP going forward.
Let me get to, looks like Carolyn from Galloway, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Carolyn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I work in Atlantic County, New Jersey, and many of my clients are on food stamps. And I also take a lot of clients to apply for food stamps. And you go down to the welfare office in Atlantic City, and you have everything that you can kind of imagine there, and you apply, and you're applying both for Medicaid, general assistance, and food stamps in one fell swoop. So sometimes it can be a bit intimidating and add to the stigma of maybe the undeserving poor versus the deserving poor. And I wonder if maybe that could help maybe change things as you talk about administrative red tape and things like that.
The idea of separating out these various services. Julie, what do you think of that?
I think that it's a great point that this is kind of a complex process to enroll in these programs that's bundled together when the welfare office administers so many programs across the board. I do think that we see less stigma with some of the other nutrition programs that aren't administered through the welfare office, for instance, the WIC program. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's important to centralize and streamline enrollment for these programs so that low-income people don't have to visit three or four different offices and speak with three or four different caseworkers to enroll. So I think there are advantages and downsides to separating out the administration of the programs.
Julie, I saw an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. The Pennsylvania DPW Secretary Beverly McGrath, rethinking the asset test that had been supported by her her predecessor. The quote was, "My focus is not on waste, fraud, and abuse." Obviously, the focus being on getting people into the program. Do you see that as a significant change in Pennsylvania?
Absolutely. We were thrilled to hear the secretary say that she was returning the department's focus to serving eligible people efficiently and effectively. I think often this rhetoric of waste, fraud, and abuse is overblown. The fraud rate in the SNAP program is less than 1% nationally, whereas we have huge numbers of families and seniors who are eligible for SNAP and not participating in the program. In Pennsylvania, about 1 in 5 eligible families does not receive SNAP. So looking at the data and looking at the need in our communities, I think it's absolutely the right focus to be taking the department in the direction of making sure that eligible folks can and do enroll in this important program.
Michael, what do you think of asset tests?
Oh, I think they're punitive and that their purpose is to keep people from receiving the benefits to which they are entitled. They're ways of keeping people off of the rolls. I don't think they have any measurable impact on fraud or waste. And with the food stamp program, as the other guest said, it's really important to emphasize that many, many people who are eligible for the program do not receive benefits, have not applied for the program. And that's really where I think our policy efforts should be directed, is making sure everybody who is eligible receives the benefits.
Julie, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And that's Julie Zabes, Policy Manager of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger. We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. Michael Katz staying with us for the rest of the hour. His 1989 book, The Undeserving Poor, has been updated and revised. He has been studying poverty for decades now. We're going to talk more about the food stamp program, but also talk about how our view of poverty and poor people affects how we think about some of these programs. Stay with us and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the official tie-in book, Behind the Scenes at Downton Abbey, a backstage pass to the set, the actors, and more. Behind the Scenes at Downton Abbey, in bookstores now.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Rachmaninoff dedicated his symphonic dances to the Philadelphia Orchestra. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the orchestra perform the symphonic dances with new works for the orchestra's principal players from composers of our day. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center. Rachmaninoff with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
War is not healthy for the environment and other living things.
Plastic bottles, styrofoam, Humvees, cars, just massive amounts of trash doused in jet fuel and lit on fire.
The way the military disposes of its garbage has become a dangerous health risk for soldiers and veterans. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Pico supports WHYY. Lowering your thermostat just 1 degree could save your business about 3% on heating costs. Pico Smart Ideas for Your Business offers ways to manage your energy costs. Details at pico.com/smartideas.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a recap, the food stamp program, also known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, is scheduled to be cut by $5 billion tomorrow. Currently, 1 in 7 Americans get food vouchers through the program. It has grown dramatically since the recession of 2008. And Michael Katz staying with us for the rest of the hour. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You just sort of threw up your hands in frustration, Michael, during the break about the fact that we are a very wealthy country. We have food. There is food. And we have people who are hungry. There's food insecurity. There is there's just a lot of want in a country with so much.
There is. I mean, it's a disconnect. We have a huge capacity for producing food. We can produce so much food we pay people not to produce it. And at the same time, we have this growing hunger and food insecurity. So that says to me that, you know, that is indicative, in fact, of how we think about poor people.
Mm. But do you think, and I sort of asked you this earlier, but do you think that the impact of the recession of 2008-2009 has created a different group of poor people? And perhaps these are people that lost their job or they lost their house and maybe had a middle-class lifestyle and then tumbled into poverty.
Yes. I mean, I think that this Great Recession, that the impact of it has been profound. It's interesting to think about it in comparison to the Great Depression of the 1930s. Because one of the things that happened in the 1930s was people fell into poverty who had never been in poverty before, and that provided a much larger constituency for the kinds of new social insurance programs that the Roosevelt administration introduced. And today, in a sense, we have something similar, that poverty, if you will, has moved up the social scale with foreclosures, people losing their jobs, people who never thought they would be in poverty, mm-hmm. finding themselves with inadequate incomes, without income at all, in danger of losing their homes. So this has increased the need, but also I would suspect has begun to increase awareness of issues of inequality and perhaps of poverty and you know, maybe in fact we're setting the stage for a more vigorous ascent to do something about these great problems.
But we still hear, you know, that they're makers and that they're takers. I mean, everybody says that, but enough people have said it in many public forums about the makers and the takers in this country.
Yes, they have said it. They've said it for hundreds of years in different ways, and they will continue to say it. I mean, the question is how their voice will be heard.
Right. Quoting at the very end of your book, your epilogue, and this is, as you say, the sort of debates about poverty go back centuries, and they are basically about three things. They are, first, how to draw the boundaries between who does and who does not deserve to be helped. Second, how we can provide help without increasing dependence or creating moral hazard. And third, what are the limits of social responsibility? What do we owe the poor and each other?
Yes.
And those are sort of enduring universal questions.
They are enduring universal questions, and every generation has asked them and answered them in different ways. They are questions of political economy, they are questions of practicality, and they are questions of ethics and social morality, all bound up in this question of poverty.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. We actually have an anonymous caller from Delaware County. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling to suggest that we change the conversation here. In 1973, my little family, when my husband, a Vietnam vet, had graduated from college and couldn't find a job, and our little family was on food stamps for a short period of time. That was a critical time in our lives, and it was very important to us, and the program really helped us. Years have gone by. We have both had extremely successful careers. We now own a business. We employ people. That's what food stamps did for our family and for the economy that we've contributed to for now, 30 more years, many more years. And I think we need to talk about the fact that food stamps is a way for us to help our neighbors who have a temporary time in need and to help those neighbors go on to fulfill their dreams and become the kind of taxpaying citizens that we want them to be. This is not something that we're not handing out money to people. We're handing out food to people when they need it at a time of need. And I think it is just revolting to think about cutting a program that helps families at a time when they just need a helping hand. That's what we're supposed to do. That's the American dream.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Michael Katz, anything you want to say in response? I mean, she sort of spoke to that paragraph that you wrote.
Yes, she spoke eloquently to that paragraph. I mean, I congratulate her on her success and on her humanity. And she's exactly right. And she does bring up a crucial point that most people who are on food stamps are, in fact, in poverty or who access other kinds of public benefits do so for only a short period of time. People go in and out of poverty throughout their life.
We were talking about people that have sort of fallen into poverty because of the recession, but as we know, there are people that have been generationally in poverty. What is the solution to their dilemma, their plight?
Well, you know, there are a core of, you know, people who are in poverty and have been in poverty for very long times, and it's a very difficult issue because the sources of their poverty are rooted partly in, you know, the circumstances in which they grew up, the kinds of educations which they received, the kind of neighborhoods in which they lived. So assisting them really requires a number of actions on a number of fronts simultaneously. There is no sort of single bullet which is going to solve that problem. I mean, we need to do a number of things. You have to help people immediately through expanding and repairing the safety net. We have to improve schools. We need to massively increase the number of jobs that are available, especially to lower skilled people, through, for instance, a large public infrastructure projects. And I think we need to put an income floor, an adequate income floor, under every American.
A version of a living wage.
A very living wage, or some kind of a basic income grant, as people call. People call it in other countries.
You know what I found interesting reading your book, then we'll get back to our callers, that some of the ideas that you just said were ones that President Nixon thought about. And it's interesting to go back and to see Nixon and others, other presidents that we associate with conservative ideas, embracing and supporting some of the ideas that sound very liberal, even radical today.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, Nixon had a family assistance plan that would have provided a kind of a basic guaranteed income, very low in the beginning, but it would have been a conceptual and a radical change in the nature of American social policy. I mean, Nixon hated social workers and welfare and a number of people who were more to the political right have seen, in fact, a kind of basic income grant as a way of bypassing the need for large-scale kind of government programs and using essentially the mechanisms of the market to help people get themselves out of poverty.
Mm. Let me see what John from South Jersey has to say. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
One of the questions that I have is I think the frustration that many Americans are sensing, particularly myself, who is generally sensitive to the plight of the poor. No one wants to see folks hungry.
Right.
But I'm feeding a family of four for much less than $600 a month.
Oh, we don't have a very good phone line for you, John, but let me just read what I see here on the computer. John from South Jersey, where's the voice of anyone who's speaking about the amount of money given to SNAP recipients? Says the temporary adjustments that was in place was higher than the amount. It sounds like what he's saying is that, you know, I have to struggle. I'm not on food stamps. I have to figure out how to make ends meet. And it sounds like he's saying, why can't people do what I do? And John, I apologize for probably butchering your question.
No, you're captured.
Okay, that's good. And I'm sorry about your phone line. Let me see what Michael Katz has to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, one, you know, can certainly sympathize with your caller, and clearly the situation is really, really tough for him. But, you know, we still have people who, for understandable reasons, cannot do what he's doing, who cannot earn enough to feed themselves and feed their families. And so, you know, we really do have a responsibility to help those people.
Well, and we should say that half of the recipients of food stamps are children, just to make sure that we don't lose sight of that.
Well, that's very true.
We were talking actually before the show began, and you make a reference in here to Jeffrey Canada's program in New York, the Harlem Children's Zone, I believe it's called.
Yes.
The idea is taking a part of New York and just investing money and time and resources and programs to try to, I guess, lift this section of New York out of poverty. Now, it's probably too soon to tell what's working and what isn't working. But do you like that idea of just focusing on a discrete kind of neighborhood?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. We have a history in this country of thinking, one way of thinking about poverty is thinking about it as a problem of place. Certain kinds of places breed poverty. So, you know, answer to that is to go into those places in a comprehensive way and kind of make changes. In the 1990s, a number of foundations acted on that idea. They had what they called comprehensive community initiatives, and they didn't work very well. You know, the history of them, the history of similar efforts like model cities, you know, it's very discouraging. So here's Canada with the Harlem Children's Zone. In a sense, I see that as the most recent updating of this strategy, doing it in some new ways. He's in New York City. He's accessed a great deal of private money. He is, you know, a very powerful and charismatic, yes, charismatic figure. So, you know, the question is, will he be able to pull it off? Will he be able to pull it off? I really hope so. It would be extraordinarily important if he does, and to understand why, and, you know.
And then duplicate, right?
And then duplicate it if possible. And, in fact, the Obama administration is trying right now to replicate the Harlem Children's Zones in a number of other cities. So we will see. But as you say, we really don't have comprehensive data, and Canada himself says it will take 20 years to know whether or not what he's doing has worked.
Let me see what Maria from Pottstown has to say. And Maria, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I am one of the recipients of the SNAP program, and that's because I have become so ill, I am disabled. and I have to accept the stamps whether I want to or not. Hmm. Mine have already been cut by $126 as of September, and I've had to charge on my credit cards at least half of the money that I had to spend on food. And it has to be nutritional food because of the disabilities trying to get me back on my feet so I can work at least part-time. And I've been an educator most of my life. And here I am not knowing what I can give up because there's nothing that I do that is non-essential. So most of us who are on the food stamps are on it legitimately. We're not trying to work the system. We're just trying to ask for a hand up. And I don't know what else I can do about this situation.
Well, Maria,
but, as I said,
and hopefully you've got a case manager or a social worker or a nurse or someone who can perhaps help you navigate through the system. But Michael Katz, another caller just saying, I need to help Bob. I don't necessarily want this, but I need it.
There is the problem in a nutshell. Both the need for the program and the consequences of cutting back.
Maria, I thank you for your call, and I wish you luck as well. It is interesting that we don't call it food stamps anymore, at least officially. It's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Is that because food stamps has had a bad connotation, do you think?
Well, I think food stamps acquired a kind of a charity connotation to it, so that, it's a kind of a negative image. And now, we don't give people stamps. It's all done through an electronic benefit system. So, in fact, the name food stamps is inaccurate.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but the clock is telling me we have to end our discussion. Michael Katz, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. He's the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History, also a research associate in the Population Studies Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And a book he wrote back in 1989, The Undeserving Poor, has just been updated, revised, and published. I'm Marty Moscoen. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program, including email and our Twitter and Facebook and podcasts. It's all there. Radio Times at whyy.org. Stay with us for hour two.